You're listening to the Bird Dog Babe podcast with my mom, Courtney Bastian.
This episode is presented to you by Purina Pro Plan and Boss Shot Shells.
You don't have to overthink it. So it might simply just be playing fetch with a soft little rope toy down the hallway. Just teaching them that natural retrieve and so that they're bringing it to your hands and they don't have anywhere else to go kind of thing. We did have antlers in their mouth as puppies. When we were kind of noticing that maybe their teeth were bothering them or their mouth was like a little bit sore, then we would use a rubber antler rather than an actual like hard bone antler. From, I would say, probably as early as 12 or 14 weeks, we had little yearling antlers out and they could with them.
Hey, Bird Dog Babes. My name is Courtney Bastian and I am obsessed with all things bird dogs. And I'm here to share with you the stories, experiences, knowledge, and opinions from the women and a few guys in the industry that are killing it. I'm a Wisconsin girl living in a Montana world, mom and two incredible kiddos, wife and occasional assistant to a pro gun dog trainer, traveling the U.S. talking about canine nutrition while hunting, raising, and competing with my German wire hair pointers and Brocky Italiano. As someone who started hunting later in life because I wanted to give my dogs the opportunity to do what they were bred to do, I'm here to help inspire, educate, and connect women to get their bird dogs out in the field and experience a bond like no other. So pour yourself a glass of wine and get ready to be challenged and encouraged while you learn. This is the Bird Dog Babe Podcast. My guest today is Tierney Ray Schneider. Tierney and her British Lab Maggie recently won the 2021 North American Shed Hunting Dog Association World Championship. Tierney shares some training tips and characteristics that ideal shed dogs possess. And it's that time of year, shed hunters are out in abundance right now. This is a fun way to keep your bird dogs and yourself active and in pursuit in the off season. All right, let's get after it. This episode is presented to you by Purina Pro Plan. What makes a great bird dog is genetics, training, and nutrition, and that's why I trust and feed Purina Pro Plan. With over 500 nutritionists, veterinarians, and scientists on staff, Pro Plan delivers a full spectrum of performance and specialized dog food formulas to help bird dogs like yours excel at every stage of life. Purina supports us, the breeders, owners, and trainers, the events we compete in, our national breed clubs, canine health research, and our committed partners to conservation groups such as Pheasants Forever, Ruffed Grouse Society, and Ducks Unlimited. 95 out of the top 100 dogs are fueled by the advanced nutrition of Purina Pro Plan. This episode is also presented by Boss Shot Shells. Copper-plated bismuth Boss provides a better, more effective non-lead option than steel and are safe to use in Grandpa's gun. Available in 10, 12, 16, 20, 28-gauge, and 410, direct-to-consumer pricing and cases shipped right to your door. Shoot Boss, pattern your shotgun to make more clean and ethical shots, reduce crippling, and remove lead from the uplands, wetlands, and all lands. Find out more at BossShotShells.com. A big shout out to the people and the partners that are helping me to keep the MP3s rolling for this podcast. My Patreon patrons, the bread and butter, the peeps, the community of like-minded individuals that are eager to learn and offer to contribute. Join us for $5 per month on Patreon.com/TheBirdDogBabe for exclusive discounts, content, and live Q&A sessions. 5% of your contribution goes to the AKC Canine Health Foundation, and another 5% goes to conservation. Dakota 283, unparalleled protection for your dog's travel to and from your next adventure. My favorite is the G3 kennel, which has a recessed handle on top that makes it easy for me to lift in and out of my truck. The keyed panel latching door makes me feel at ease on trips when I have to leave dogs in my truck when I stop for fuel. An added bonus is the drain hole in the back, which makes cleaning a breeze when my dog has been run hard and put away wet. Go to Dakota283.com and use promo code BIRDDOGBABE for 10% off. And by Siren, shotguns for women. Siren carries the only full line of women's shotguns. They are dedicated to providing the equipment and knowledge that make shooting and hunting more enjoyable and less stressful. Newer seasoned hunter, Siren offers multiple options that fit right out of the box. No more compromises. Go to SirenUSA.com and check out all the options available for upland, waterfowl, sporting, and trap shotguns. And while you're there, say hello to Julia, Siren's new 12-gauge sporting that is one of the most stunning shotguns I've laid my eyes on. Good morning, Tierney, and welcome to the podcast.
Good morning, Courtney.
So you are coming to us from Iowa, is that right?
Yes, northeast Iowa, right along the Mississippi River.
Nice, nice area. This time of the year, I was super excited to talk to you about this because a lot of the bird dog owners are out and about doing this right now because the snow's melted and people are out with their bird dogs in search of the shed antlers from the ungulates that dropped, you know, what do they usually drop between January and April? And you just came off of an awesome Master World Championship. So I'm excited to dig into all things shed hunting with you today.
Absolutely. It's definitely prime time competition season. Prime time deer are dropping their antlers right now. Or just got done with those. So wild shed hunting. It's been a busy time of year for us.
Mm-hmm. So is that typical that with the competitions that they're around the same time of actual shed hunting season?
With the World Championship and the Nationals competition, those are always in around like late March to early April, somewhere in there. And that's pretty typical to have those. As far as the rest of our competitions, those sporadically pop up around around the calendar year, whatever. But also, I would say as the sport continues to grow, it seems that it's pretty much becoming something that we could do every weekend if we wanted to. But definitely the busiest times of the year are the spring and the fall.
Nice. So tell us about the World Championship and with your dog, Maggie.
Yeah, so Maggie is my crazy little black British lab. She has a ton of drive and is always willing to please me no matter what she has to do to achieve her goal. For the World Championship, I ran that series through the North American Shed Hunting Dog Association. And to qualify for that, you had to be titled as a master dog. So there's quite a few requirements leading up to that. But basically, the highest titled dogs in the country are who get the opportunity to compete at that level. So that was very exciting for us. She is not even 2 years old yet. And it was,
wow.
It was awesome. I ran my first course and it was just a smoking fast time. I think I had like 2 minutes and 14 seconds or something crazy. And at that point I knew I kind of just had to go for it because if I'm going to run that one that fast, I got to go for the rest of them. So
yeah.
I was over the moon ecstatic, and super excited.
Okay, so this, I need to have a breakdown of how this works because I have not been to one of these and they sound like a lot of fun. So how many series is it? Or do you have to qualify to go on to the next? And then there's a total of how many?
So there's two different organizations you can run through. The Master World Championship that we just won is through the North American Shed Hunting Dog Association. That's NASHDA, and was started by Tom Dockin with Oak Ridge Kennels. That's the organization that's really been around the longest. And I guess just to kind of explain the format for that, there are three different categories that you can run in, and you have to start in the junior series. So when you start at the junior level, the antlers are pretty, I would say you're really set up for success. So the idea is that you're learning and growing with your dog. So being able to work through a course where the antlers aren't necessarily buried super hard. They're not in a lot of cover, sometimes even just in like a mowed field or there's been times where we've done them in a city park. So and with just like light cover, they'll bring brush in or maybe it's just a trail through the woods. But on the style course, it can range in size, but there's 6 antlers that are planted for you. And you walk behind the dog, and the dog must find and then bring you all 6 antlers. The idea behind NASHA really is that it is a pass-fail situation in 15 minutes. When you get to the world championship, though, that kind of is a different ballgame. It really is a race against time, because you're competing against the other dogs. Whereas just a normal qualifier would be a pass-fail situation. After you have earned 6 passes at the junior level, you get to move on to the senior level, and the difficulty gets a little bit harder. So the cover might be a little bit thicker. There also is one of your whitetail antlers will be a water plant. That might be in a natural water source, such as like a pond or a creek or on the edge. Or that might be in like a mineral tub that's been buried into the ground, just so that you can retrieve the antler and have a water source for the course. It just depends on what the terrain allows and what there is available. So with that, the antlers are definitely a little bit harder because you are learning and growing with your dog. And it's still the same requirements. So 6 whitetail antlers retrieved to hand in 15 minutes. And that also could just be a course where the boundaries are marked in the middle of the woods. It could be in a field of tenure. We've even seen a cornfield. That's one of our favorites in Iowa because that's where we do most of our shed hunting.
Right.
It could be all sorts of places. And then after you get 6 passes at the senior level, then you move on to the master level. And that's really, that's where Maggie and I had to become qualified to be able to run at the Master World Championships. So to run at the World Championship, you also have to have 3 master passes to qualify. And then after you have 6, you get that title. So Maggie actually does not have her master title yet. But she did have her 3 passes that qualified her to be able to run at the championship.
Okay.
So for the master, though, the way that it changes is you still have 6 antlers, but one of them is planted in the water, just like the senior. One of them is a yearling shed, so much smaller in size. And then one of them is an elk antler that's between 5 and 8 pounds.
Wow.
So that it just adds a little bit of diversity to what you're doing, I guess. It really makes dogs be challenged to kind of be able to retrieve all kinds of things in all kinds of situations. Also, I think it's probably important that I note that the antler isn't buried, like submerged 100% in the water. There are normally about half an antler exposed, or 1 or 2 times.
Okay. So on this course, are you walking specific areas, or are you sending the dog out on blinds? What does that look like?
So you are always following behind your dog on the course, and you'll see that handlers kind of handle that a different way. Some like to have their dog hunt a little bit closer to them. Some will hunt 50 yards out ahead, maybe something in between. Maggie hunts very big, so she is always 50 yards out, sometimes hunting too big, and I have to call her back. The goal is that you really got to get the dog downwind so that they're able to wind the scent on the antler. The scent that NASHA uses is called rack wax. And like if you're out wild scent hunting, there's a scent on the antler. It doesn't necessarily come from the entire bone. There's a little wax ring around the base of the antler that you'll notice. And that's really where the scent comes from.
Interesting. So are they on a leash or a long line, like of sort
no.
at all at any level, or are they always off lead?
Always off lead. Yep.
Okay. Are you judged on how much control you have of them?
Nope, not at all. So The only thing that you're judged on is just the antlers retrieved to hand within the time allotted.
Okay. So they have to, in all the levels, they have to retrieve directly to hand.
Yes, that is the case for NASHA. When we'll talk about UKC here in a little while, They do have a little bit different requirements for those dogs beginning at the lower level.
Okay. So in NASHDA, do they have to have a specific presentation where they're like in heel position, sitting, and then giving you the retrieve, or can they just come straight in, or can they drop it a foot away from you and you pick it up? What's the requirements for that?
So there's not necessarily a position that the dog has to handle to bring you the antler. Oftentimes Maggie will come back and she's so amped up, she'll actually like jump up on my stomach and bounce off of me and take off again. So there's not necessarily a position that the dog has to take in order to consider that retrieve, but the antler does have to touch the handler's hand. And beyond just touching, they have to grab it. So if the dog would drop it at the handler's feet, the dog has to pick that up and give that to the handler. I guess I forgot to mention also that when a dog finds an antler on a course, the judge will call fine. And at the point the judge calls fine, the handler has to stop. You can't advance at all. So you have to stop. And then when the dog has the antler in the handler's hand, the judge will call retrieve. And then you're fine to move. And then the judge will hold on to the antlers for the remainder of the course.
Wow. That's really impressive. And you need 6 passes for each level to earn the title.
Yep, that's correct.
Okay. So, I mean, how did you get started in this, Tierney? What made you even give this a try?
So my fiance is a farm boy through and through. And he was not much for house pets or any kind of indoor animal at all when we met about 9 years ago. So I worked on him for quite a few years, and I was like, I just really want a dog. I just really want a dog, you know? And we developed many hobbies together and all sorts of things that we like to do. And, he had said, well, Tierney, if we're going to have a dog, it has to have a job. Like, it absolutely has to have a dog, and it needs to know what its job is. It needs to have a purpose. So we began kind of our search, like, okay, well, what could we really do? What could we do? And we ended up with our first black lab, our first yellow lab, Sadie, and she was our shed dog. So she has a job. She knows how to find antlers. And really, when we got her, we had no intention of ever doing the competition thing. We would read through the rules and we were like, oh, that is crazy. Our dogs will never be able to do that. I hardly even understand the rules. It's way too much to handle. So we were like, there's no way. And we decided that, okay, well, we have Sadie. We like shed hunting. And we kind of set a goal for ourselves. Like, we want to find a certain number of antlers. So we started to get, we got on the internet and we were looking at places that we could go or things that we could do to find antlers. And we have quite a bit of farm ground here ourselves in Northeast Iowa, but we wanted to go farther than just here. So we ended up at Brown's Hunting Ranch in South Dakota. And every year you can go there and you can go on a wild shed hunt. I think it's normally the first weekend of April. They always have a NASHDA shed trial. And then on the Sunday, so that's Friday, Saturday. And then on the Sunday, they always have a wild shed derby. So we had went to Brown's, I think, 2 weeks prior to when this competition and this wild shed derby was supposed to take place. And we had a pretty successful weekend. I want to say we found like 30 or so antlers. Not necessarily easy. That's probably about 12 miles apiece each day. But we were excited. We were glad. We were pretty excited about the outcome and glad we had some antlers to take home. So, while we were sitting there at the lodge, you know, just talking to the owners, and he was bringing up the shed trial and the derby, he actually talked us into coming back 2 weeks later. So we went back, and then there's other people rolling in for the same competition and for the derby, and everyone was very welcoming and nice, and our first trial didn't go well. We timed out our very first run ever. So how defeating to drive all the way to South Dakota. We didn't want to do this anyways. And we timed out. So we were like, okay, well, we got to do something differently for tomorrow and
kind of talked with everyone and everyone was helpful. And our second day we did get a pass and we were over the moon excited. So that was kind of where it started for us. But yeah.
And how long ago was that?
That would have been, I bet it was 4.5 years. No, it was probably 4 years ago.
Okay. So you said Sadie's a yellow lab?
Yep. Sadie's a yellow lab. We run all British labs. So
okay.
Just a smaller frame lab. They're supposed to have a pretty natural retrieve and kind of an on-off switch when we're talking about going into the house and out into the field. We've had pretty good luck with them. I wouldn't necessarily say I know that all of like those things are characteristics of a British lab. Sure, fine.
Right.
But we just, yeah. I mean, our biggest frame one is about 54 pounds. So especially with three dogs in the house, the smaller the better.
I love how successful you've been convincing your husband to not only get one dog, but now you have three.
Yeah.
And they're in the house.
They're all in the house.
That's awesome. You go, girl. That had to have been a bit of a transition for him, but he's like completely on board with the multiple dogs and in the house clearly now, right?
Oh, absolutely. And now he certainly wouldn't trade it for the world. Things like the dog on the couch or the dog on the bed, things like that, I think he could probably live without. But once one does it, they all seem to want to do it. And I mean, he loves having them as companions also.
That's awesome. How often are you guys training the dogs?
So I would say when we got the dogs, it was pretty frequently. I mean, like, I think there is kind of a misconception that, oh, you're going to go out and you're going to work with your dog for 3-4 hours a day and you got to do this and you got to do that. No, like really, it kind of just starts like 15, 20 minutes here, 15, 20 minutes there, like a couple times a day. But now like, our dogs I would call them seasoned shed dogs. They know what they're doing. They know their job. They don't forget the scent. They always have the retrieve for the antler. Now it's really just kind of keeping them conditioned. And then if we are headed to a competition or it's shed season and we really need to get them amped up and ready to go, then it might be a little bit more consistently, just like working them on some drills or taking them out just to run and get some exercise, that kind of thing. So we're really, the national championship is done, the world championship is done, all of that stuff is over for the year. We're really done wild shed hunting now for probably the year. So it'll just be a few competitions here and there until fall time. So our dogs are really just probably now, I would say they're going out and running probably 2 or 3 nights a week. And that might just be something simple like, running with the four-wheeler or the gator and just getting some exercise around the field or playing fetch out in the cornfield or the bean field kind of thing. So nothing too intense right now. Once they kind of have it, it seems like they don't really forget it.
Yeah. Are you doing like condition retrieve with them then, since you need that retrieve portion is so important in the testing?
I wouldn't say that. We're really always, it seems like they, we never have an issue with them retrieving. A lot of times too, like now you'll notice that they're like so comfortable with it. And, I don't know, like, it's just their game. Like that's their passion. Like the dogs love it. Really they'll kind of even just like run and scoop it on the way through.
Okay. And why the British lab? And clearly after the first one, you had two more. So you really liked the breed. And why that breed?
We've always kind of just like wanted a lab, I guess, but we wanted something small. There was a few years ago, well, it was probably would have been 2 or 3 years prior to us getting Sadie. We were at the Iowa Deer Classic and Jeremy Moore was there with Dogbone. He was there and he had some British labs that were place trained. They were puppies. They were place trained and on their place and amongst all like of these thousands of people just sitting there on their cot. And we were pretty intrigued by that. And kind of at that point, we were like, okay, like this is the size of dog we want. If we ever get one, this is like what we want it to, like the characteristics we kind of want it to have. And that's kind of, I guess, where it started. Then once we got Sadie and we loved her size, we like loved her mannerism. She
I guess we just decided to get more. I don't know.
Is that a common breed when you're at the competitions?
I would say that the number one breed that we do see among competitions is labs. Not necessarily a British lab. I would say all kinds of labs. American is probably the number one. But there are other breeds also. So there's some people that run Malinois. There's German Shorthair Pointers, Golden Retrievers. There's a guy in Michigan that has a little pit bull that was rescued from a humane society. So you see really just a wide array of different breeds of dogs. But, yeah, there definitely are a majority of labs have started recognizing non-retriever breeds compared to retriever breeds also when we're talking about performance over the course of the entire year.
Okay. Are they splitting that up then to two different, like would a non-retriever compete against a retriever breed or are they separate?
They would compete against the same, but when it goes to like recognizing dog of the year for UKC, then they're recognizing dog of the year retriever breed and then dog of the year non-retriever breed. So dog of the year is just performance throughout the entire year and it's based on by a board at the UKC.
Okay. What else is different in the UKC trials than the NASHTA ones?
So the UKC, obviously still same common goal, but the way that the UKC works is that there's two classes. There's working and there's champion. And you can start at whatever class that you would like to start at. There also is a division for the youth. So that's something that's pretty appealing to families. So with the working division, I guess for both courses, working, champion, and youth, the courses are 50 by 100, so about the size of a football field, and they're divided into six zones. So generally two zones and then two zones and then two zones. So like, I don't know, if you think about like a window that has like six panes, that's what it would look like if it was the size of a football field. And there's an antler in, there's five antlers planted. And when you show up at the handlers meeting for the day, you draw a card. And based on the card that you draw, there will be one zone that only the judge knows that will not have an antler in it. So it's just kind of used to, I would say, trick the handler or to test your handling abilities. So in the working class, the antlers are planted pretty easily. There's not any like really dense cover, not normally like a watershed kind of thing. And you have to retrieve four of the five antlers in 15 minutes. And in the working class for UKC, the dog can drop the bone at the handler's feet within one step of the handler.
Okay.
So if the handler can take one step, bend down, and pick it up off the ground, then that can be considered a retrieve. For the champion class, that does get a little bit more intense. And there's five antlers, so all the same requirements, 50 by 100, the six zones, still draw the card. But for the champion class, you have to retrieve all five antlers in 15 minutes. And then more than just a pass-fail, there also is a competition for first through fourth place. And different point values are awarded based on first through fourth place. And then based on, like, there's different titles that can be achieved based on the point values. So for working class, you have to have five working passes to achieve a working title. And you can get as many working titles as you would like before moving to the champion class, or you can stay in the working class, kind of just up to the handler and dog. For the champion class, there's different titles that can be earned. So like 100 points is a champion title, and the point values kind of probably mean nothing to everyone right now. But so you can get the champion, and then you can achieve the elite status, which is the next status, and then also the Hall of Fame status, and that's a pretty prestigious award, I would say. I think there's currently only four or five dogs that have the Hall of Fame status, and that's 1,000 points. So That's pretty awesome.
That's pretty dedicated.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So in the UKC trials, is that all whitetail as well? Or do you have elk, moose. Do you have anything else?
Those are all whitetail antlers. There is a club in Kansas, so Kansas Shed Dogs, and they use mule deer antlers because that is an antler that they can find on their home turf. Mm-hmm. So it's been approved for them to use muleys, but there are not any elk antlers or moose paddles or anything like that. No.
Okay. Describe like the difference between having it as a hobby versus competition, because clearly you got the dogs to first have it as a hobby, you know, is it like you said, like a job for the dogs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like, was it just getting that invite back to the place in South Dakota that made you want to start doing competitions? Or
so I would say, like, I mean, Tony and I always talk about this. So like people have their hobbies, you know, like we live on the river. So everyone has a boat, everyone has a camper. Everyone's traveling, doing these kinds of things, doing whatever your hobby may be. So ours really, I would say it still is a hobby. So yeah, we are very competitive and, we love to have a good performance with our dogs, but for us, the competitions, the wild shed hunting, all of it has just really become a hobby that we thoroughly enjoy. More so than just running the dogs and having that bond with your dog is really the camaraderie that happens when all these people get together and we all have a common interest. So yeah, I mean, we've met some of the best people through this sport that we never would have met had we not gotten into it. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
It could be looked at a whole bunch of different ways. So there are people too that do this as a business. So
really?
Yeah, I mean, if you think about like a professional dog trainer who is mm-hmm. just trying to, with the UKC, you're actually earning titles for the dog and it goes on their pedigree. So there's people too that are just trying to build up the pedigree on a dog and then they can sell it or they can have puppies, that kind of thing. So sure. If you think as your purpose changes, your attitude towards it changes, I guess, or your goal changes maybe. Mm-hmm. For us, like if we do well, you know, that's just awesome. Like it's something cool we get to celebrate. If we don't, then we don't. It just wasn't our day kind of thing.
Right. So like in bird dogs and field trials and different competitions, people start gearing their breeding programs towards these dogs that are winning frequently. You're selecting like the best dogs in that are continuing to win field trials to really maximize on those genes. In the shed dog world, are there breeders that are specifically breeding for that purpose?
I certainly think that it's taken into consideration when breedings occur. Personally, so our first one, Sadie, she came from a kennel and I mean, yeah, I don't know that she was necessarily bred for that. Our second two, Eva and Maggie, they actually came out of kind of just like a no-name female from Wisconsin, and she was bred to a big field trial dog. He is like a highest titled dog, internationally titled dog or something. So not necessarily that sheds were their background, but both of them have been really successful for us. So we knew once we got Eva, who is our middle dog, she's just a black British also. Once we got her, we were like, we have to have another one just like her. Like, we love her. She does awesome. Like, she is Tony's dog through and through. And she just accomplished some really cool things. So we knew like we wanted another one. And then the second litter they had of the same pairing, we got Maggie. But I wouldn't necessarily say that they're really bred specifically for sheds. There mm-hmm. are like maybe some pairings that have occurred that people are doing just specifically for sheds, but it is such a new sport too. I think, it's just not as big as the whole bird thing. So finding a good pairing or, I guess breeding exactly for sheds isn't always the goal.
Right.
Plus, there's a lot of dogs that are really, they're versatile in what they're doing, and some are running the HRC, some are bird hunting, some are pheasant dogs. Like, there's all sorts of different goals, I guess. So it really is based on the owner and what the owner is wanting for for their dog.
What have you noticed as far as like characteristics between Maggie and Eva versus Sadie? Like when you got Eva and you wanted another one, what were some of the characteristics that she had that you wanted another one just like that?
I would say that just having a high level of drive and toughness.
Okay.
So Sadie is, she can have drive. She can have toughness if she wants to have it. She just doesn't have the same passion for it that the other two really do. But she's my dog that I could take out wildcat hunting and she'll just run around for hours and just kind of do her own little thing, you know? She can run competitions. She does fine. She, just doesn't have as much toughness and drive to like really be like charging through briars if there's an antler in there or, just in like in a creek to get an antler kind of thing. So I would say really just the toughness and drive. So if a dog doesn't want to find antlers, they don't want to have drive to do it and they don't want to have a quick retrieve. I mean, they might not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What about use of nose? Are you noticing differences with dogs that have like a better nose?
I certainly think that's something that has to be considered. Yeah. When you're choosing a dog for, especially sheds, because 90% of what they're using to find an antler is their nose. That's obviously where they first are able to detect the antler. All three of ours do have a pretty good nose and, they can smell, but you do got to get them downwind. So that's pretty important. I also think too, like it's important to note that they do use their nose and that is their number one sense, but it's pretty cool that they use their eyes too.
So they're actively looking for it as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you notice, like, are their tails going 100 miles per hour when you can tell that they've either seen or smelled that shed?
There certainly are different indicators with dogs. And, yeah, tails are a very good indicator that you can oftentimes tell.
Mm-hmm. This is really interesting. And I guess it would be similar characteristics of what you would want in a good bird dog as well, because you're kind of describing like that grit, that ability or drive to be able to go through the thicker cover to get into what it is they're looking for versus some that would maybe see that cover as a wall or a barrier and go, I'll skip and look somewhere else.
Yeah, exactly.
What is kind of the training process when you're starting out? I mean, are you, when they're 8 weeks old that you're getting a new puppy, are you starting to do kind of fundamentals right away? Do you wait till they're 6 months old? What have you found in your experience?
So everyone kind of has their different philosophy on that. A lot of people will say, wait till they're 6 months old, wait till their mouth isn't soft anymore. You really want them to listen and be able to pick up on it kind of thing. For us, we have really kind of just started them once we got them. And I think it doesn't have to be, you don't have to overthink it. So it might simply just be playing fetch with a soft little rope toy down the hallway, just teaching them that natural retrieve. And so that they're bringing it to your hand and they don't have anywhere else to go. Kind of thing. Ours, we did have antlers in their mouth as puppies. When we were kind of noticing that maybe their teeth were bothering them or their mouth was like a little bit sore, then we would use a rubber antler rather than an actual like hard bone antler. But from, I would say probably as early as 12 or 14 weeks, we had little yearling antlers out and they could with them. So I think that it can really kind of just depend on the philosophy of the trainer, exactly what they're comfortable with or they're thinking. So, yeah.
What about like having the tines up or down? Does that vary? And I mean, and even in competition, do they sometimes have them turned up to find?
I would say more than not, the tine of the antler is up.
Okay.
I know the tine, I mean, yeah, you don't want your dog to really like poke themselves in the mouth. But right. It does certainly happen. They kind of learn how to grab the antler and the way the antler is going to flip when they do pick up on it. And they become pretty comfortable with it over time. But I do think that as they're learning, it helps to for them to just be able to grab onto the main beam of the antler.
Okay. So when they're like as puppies, are you putting them down when you're training, or does it just not matter? Are you varying both ways, even when they're young?
Both ways, because a lot of time you're just throwing it, and it can land either way. There are tips and tricks too, where you can take and you could put a tennis ball on the antler so that they have like a soft spot to grab, or so that like you're teaching them, oh hey, you should grab the antler right here. You can take a pool noodle and tape a little piece of a pool noodle on an antler, give them another soft spot to grab. It could be as simple as just putting tape on a certain antler if it's something that's concerning. I don't really think that we have ever really used any of those strategies, but a lot of people do.
Okay. Yeah, because you'd think that you want to teach them to pick it up in the, you know, like the thicker area, somewhere where it would be in the middle so it's balanced when they're holding it in their mouth.
Yeah, it seems normally they try to grab them around, like, on the main beam around the G2 of the antler is really what it kind of seems like. So the G2 would be not the brow tine, but the next one up.
Ooh, explain those to me. This is the first I've heard that terminology.
So an antler has like the base, which is like where the burr is. And that's where it like connects onto the whitetail's head. And then the tine that comes up first, that would be like right on their forehead, essentially, that is your brow tine. And then as the antlers come off the main beam out toward the tip of the main beam, then it just counts up. So you have your brow tine, then you have your G2 and your G3. And I don't know what those stand for, but...
Okay. It's interesting. And if you ever want to learn about like keels and crops of birds and stuff, I can share that with you, but I don't know this stuff very well. It's something that we like to do, you know, when we're out in the spring and with the dogs and looking for something to keep them active. But why is this such a popular thing, do you think, with people? I mean, are the antlers selling for a lot of money, or what's kind of the motivation to do this?
So our motivation, I would say, really is, we try to follow genetics of the deer on our farm pretty close. But we're finding antlers and we're keeping them, kind of thing. We don't necessarily sell anything that we find. It kind of just becomes like a goal. So there was a year the first year we had Eva, we found 100 antlers and we were pretty excited about that. I wouldn't necessarily say that for us, there's really a goal or any kind of incentive other than it's our hobby. It's fun. It's like our game. But for some people, they are selling them. And the market on antlers is actually pretty high right now. I would say generally they'll sell for around $12 a pound.
Wow. That's incredible.
We were at the Great Iowa Antler Auction this year, though, and there were antlers that were bringing $18, $19 a pound. So that was pretty insane. And I mean, those are just going for like antler chews for dogs or like jewelry or like cabinet pulls, like things like that.
So is there like an aging or like quality determination between them then that would provide, that would make them more expensive than other ones?
I definitely think, obviously a natural antlers have a little bit darker of a color, than they would coming off of like a game farm. Also if an antler is sitting out in the wild for more than a year, there's a very strong chance that it got chewed by, like a squirrel, or, it got chewed on by a coyote, or, all sorts of different, I guess, damaging things can happen. The sun also bleaches them and they start to get kind of chalky. So an antler that's chalky is not as hard, and the quality definitely does go down. So they don't bring as much money as a fresh whitetail antler that is in good condition with good color would.
Okay. And those are like the more browner ones then?
Yep. So they have a darker color. And I have always kind of been told or like thought that coloring comes from like a deer like rubbing on a tree.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. And I'm thinking, like, when I'm in Cabela's and I see these antler chandeliers, they are the ones that have, like, the more brown on them.
Yep.
So that would make sense. Is that, like, typically, besides kind of decoration and the dog chews, what would anybody else use them for? Jewelry?
Yeah, I think jewelry is another growing thing that they are used for. Like if you go to Cabela's and they have like the rattling antlers, like that deer hunters would take with them to a stand. That would be another use for us. They're kind of just display pieces. Other than that, I really don't know the buzz.
Yeah, there is I know, a small town near us, a house was just broken into, and whoever robbed the house, like, sawed off the antlers of the elk mount that was in there. I just think that's so bizarre.
That's so strange.
It is. I know. Well, now it's like a thing around our little valley here. They're like putting just this elk head in random places around the valley that has no antlers on it. And like he's wearing sunglasses and a face mask and a lay now. So it's just a really bizarre thing but yeah, somebody actually broke into a house and took the antlers off of this mount. Like this is for real. This is a thing. People really want these things.
That's crazy.
It is. What about like shed hunting and like the bird dog feel? Have you heard like that shed hunting is going to ruin a bird dog because like they're smelling it? And maybe they're out there looking for sheds more than they would be birds, or what's your kind of take on that?
I think that there's a lot of people that purpose. I would more or less say that people think that birds will ruin a shed dog. So when you give a dog a live bird, that's way more interesting than a dead antler. Like, it's not moving. It's not doing anything. That's just in the ground. So I think that I've never heard someone say, oh, shed hunting is going to ruin my bird dog. No. In fact, a lot of people that run these trials with us in these different series, they are attending HRC events, or they are in a duck blind every weekend, or out pheasant hunting. I mean, they're definitely doing all sorts of different things. And no, I haven't ever heard that it ruins them at all.
Mm-hmm. It just, I think if anything, it helps them with conditioning and keeping active, using that nose out of bird season.
Absolutely. It definitely does.
Yeah. So how often are the different competitions, like whether it's NASHDA or the UKC shed trials, can people find those like in every state every weekend?
I would definitely say that they're growing. You probably not every weekend, and certainly not every state every weekend. When we started this probably about 4 years ago, it really kind of was just the states, I would say, kind of around us. So like Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa, Indiana, Mississippi, like places like that. Now it really is growing. There's actually a club in Northern Idaho that is looking at getting started currently. And it was a new event that just occurred in South Carolina. So I think it's certainly growing, but not every single weekend, every single state. And it's kind of, I would say, more centrally located in the United States, as of right now, anyways.
How far do you typically have to travel?
Well, we're kind of crazy. we were really, with Eva, our middle lab, we had a goal to have her earn her Hall of Fame title before she was 3 years old. So, and we did achieve that last October. So I think she was actually only 2.5 probably, but
wow.
So we were traveling pretty far. I mean, as far as Indiana, Ohio, Kansas, South Dakota, Minnesota,
Savannah, Mississippi, like we're kind of all over the place. Is everyone all over the place? Nah, I wouldn't say so. Our kind of rule of thumb now is if it's less than 7 hours, there's probably a good chance we'll be there. Anything more than 10 gets to be real tough.
Are they typically in the fall then, or is it year round?
More year round, I would say, especially as it continues to grow. So it kind of picks up probably end of August, beginning of September, and then runs through maybe mid-November, and then it'll pick up again starting in February, and that'll go through the World Championship and the National Championship. And then once those, like, there's others that are kind of in between also, but those are really the busy seasons.
Okay. Do the dogs struggle a little bit during the summer months doing this, or is it short enough time that they're really not having that, those heat issues?
Well, there's certainly people that would probably disagree with me, but I think that our dogs do struggle when it is warm. We were in Milwaukee, Wisconsin a couple weeks ago. It was probably like 76 and pretty humid, and the dogs were hot. So I think it definitely does affect their performance. I think that when it starts to green up, that also is another characteristic that makes it a little bit trickier for them than it potentially would, say, in November or December when there's no cover, just like dead leaves kind of thing, and it is much cooler. There's certainly a difference, at least for our dogs anyways.
And there's a water component in them. So will a lot of the dogs just go take a little dip in the water while they're in the during the competition?
It definitely happens, yes. That are looking at hosting like an event when there is a chance that it could be warm out, they do keep like water in mind as far as at least having a water source off the course so that people can give their dogs a swim afterward if they need to cool them off.
Okay. So you have, you said you have Eva in the Hall of Fame?
Yep, Eva's in the Hall of Fame. So she would be Maggie's full-blooded sister from the first litter of that pairing.
Okay. So who are you testing or competing with all of them right now, or are you just focusing on one or two?
So Sadie was competing up until probably, I don't know, the last couple months here. We haven't had Sadie running anymore. She kind of has just become my little couch potato snuggle dog, I guess. But the other two, Maggie and Eva, are both running. On a normal weekend, Tony and I are both traveling, so Tony will run Eva and then I will run Maggie, but it can go either way also. So just we're mostly focusing on Maggie and Eva at the moment.
Okay. Are you looking to get Maggie into the Hall of Fame as well?
That would ultimately be our goal, yes.
Okay. So do you find between you and your fiance that you guys are a little bit competitive against each other then? Because it sounds like he runs Eva and you're running Maggie.
Yeah, that definitely happens. And it normally seems like they're pretty head in head. It's actually, it makes it kind of interesting because, so this world championship that Maggie just won, Eva actually got second.
Okay.
So had Maggie not won it, then Eva would have had it. So that adds to that little bit of competition there. And then, for the UKC, they award Dog of the Year, as I was talking about a little bit earlier. And Eva won Dog of the Year last year before Maggie was really running. And Tony was wanting to have a shot at it again this year. And she had been nominated for Dog of the Year. And Maggie actually won Dog of the Year earlier this spring also. And beat Eva out there too. So it does become competitive over the course of the year. And I would say weekend to weekend.
Sure. So at the world competition, what was the difference between the performances of Maggie and Eva?
I would say that Maggie had three really, really fast times. Eva had just had three really good times, but just not as fast as Maggie. And I would say I got done with those runs and I just thought to myself, If my times aren't good enough, they're just not good enough. Not that there was a single step or thing that I could have done differently to make my times any faster. Never at any point was I like, oh, I should have done this or I should have done that. I would call them three runs of a lifetime is what I would say.
Aw, that's awesome.
Just well, so happened to be put together at the right time in the right place.
Right, right. Well, congratulations. That's super exciting. Are you guys hoping and planning to go next year then?
Oh, certainly. Yep. I mean, that's kind of what we train for all year and kind of practice and work for is just that you get that one weekend to kind of put it all together and make it count. So right. We'll definitely be in it next year.
Is it always at the same location?
It's not, no.
Okay.
Dawkins tried to normally move it around. It's been in Indiana. It's been at their location multiple times. UKC was in Ohio the first year. No, Michigan. I guess they didn't really have it the first year. It was just more or less an awards. But the first year, then it was in Ohio. And then this year, it was in Illinois. Last year, kind of like all this COVID stuff came out right about the time that, I mean, we're supposed to be leaving. Like hotels were booked. Everything was kind of set for the year. So nobody got to compete last year. So that was kind of discouraging.
What do you guys have, I mean, going forward here? Because you just graduated from grad school. You're a fourth grade teacher and you're getting married soon. So but it sounds like you were just in Milwaukee recently and then the championship. So, I mean, all this stuff going on, it's not holding back on your competing schedule, is it?
No, it's not.
But you did take off the weekend of your wedding, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, it's kind of like the running joke that everyone likes to try and get a rag out of me that they're going to have an event at our farm the weekend of our wedding. So since I'll be here, they might as well have an event. And I'm always like, no way, Jose. Like, this is not happening.
And you're having the wedding at your farm there. And you guys said you have a barn.
Yep. We have a barn that we are currently working to renovate. So,
that's so cool.
70 some days to get it done.
And do you have antler decor, placed throughout your decorations for your wedding?
I actually do not. Everyone is so surprised to hear that.
Oh, so you've heard that question already several times.
I have heard that. Like, oh, those will be your centerpieces, right? You'll have an antler chandelier, right? And I actually don't have anything.
Huh. Are the dogs going to be part of it?
They will certainly be a part of pictures. I'm not sure that they'll be in anything other than that, but they will definitely be in our pictures.
Awesome. Well, cool. Congratulations on everything you have going on, Tierney, and what you've accomplished. You're a busy lady. And it's really cool to have learned more about shed hunting. And now I'm anxious to get out. I'm like, tomorrow seems a little bit open. I think we'll go head up the mountain and see what we can find.
Yeah, that sounds awesome.
Yeah. So I am going to put all the information in the show notes for people to be able to find the NASHTA competitions and the UKC field trials. But can you tell us here where they could find out more information on those competitions?
Absolutely. So the United Kennel Club has an Elite Shed Dog Series Facebook page. North American Shed Hunting Dog Association also has a Facebook page, and the information can be found on their websites. As far as Iowa goes, you can check us out on Iowa Shed Dogs on Facebook also, and we are normally posting our events and sometimes other people's events are sharing those. Most local clubs have their own Facebook page that can be followed, as well as you can shoot us an email at iowashedogs@gmail.com.
Perfect. Am I forgetting anything else that you wanted to mention on our topic today?
I do not think so. I think that there are so many dogs that can do this. And I think that it's nothing to be scared of or nothing to feel like, wow, that is way too hard for me to do. It really isn't more than anyone can handle, I feel like. It's not rocket science. So definitely feel free to reach out if anybody has any questions or anything. We're always more than willing to help or grow the sport.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Tierney. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Courtney.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Bird Dog Babe Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, share it and tag me and someone that would benefit from listening. Please help me out by giving the podcast a rating and review on whichever platform you're listening from, and hit subscribe so you don't miss an episode. Be sure to join me on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. And if you're interested in some Bird Dog Babe swag or gear that I rely on, be sure to check out the store on thebirddogbabe.com. And most importantly, don't forget to support the organizations that are working hard to conserve the birds you're chasing after and the public lands in which you hunt.